The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Thought I'd look these people up, you know, psych them out.
Hi, Connie. There's a bomb in your house, and it's going to blow in about 3, 2, 1.
5 contenders picked at random. Their every move caught on tape. Their only goal, take out the other contenders and become the ultimate survivor.
Hey, what about the body?
Let them deal with it.
This summer, one film is taking America's latest obsession beyond reality. Series 7.
My boyfriend got me this bulletproof vest.
Rolling Stone says these contestants make Survivor look like Sesame Street.
Get out here and fight like a man!
Go out there and tell her to come in for a snack and blow my head off and let's get this show on the road.
It's outrageously funny.
If you are calling to score a kill, press 1 now.
This Friday, get to a theater and get in the game. Series 7. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent. Starts Friday.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me again this week is Rob St. Mary.
Thanks, Mike. Glad my number came up, but the question is, do you have any bean dip?
This week we're discussing Daniel Minahan's Series 7, The Contenders, starring Brooke Smith as Dawn Legardo, the current series winner. Her prize for winning Series 6 is being a contestant on Series 7, where she has to hunt and kill 5 other contestants, including an old boyfriend. The 2001 movie was shot like the season finale of a reality show, recapping the season and showing us the highlights of a very vicious game as it winds to a close. Rob, what are your thoughts on the film? When did you see it, and what were your initial impressions?
Well, I saw it back in 2001 when it first came out on VHS. I was working at Thomas Video, which is a pretty well-known cult film emporium here in Metro Detroit. And I was, like, completely blown away by it when I saw it, and for several reasons. One is, the film's such a great satire of reality TV. And since then, that whole genre has just kind of exploded. And I've never watched it or got into it because, to me, it's like reality TV is kind of far from reality.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're going to have a show called Survivor, it's like, I'm sorry, but they should kill each other. It should be like Lord of the Flies. That's just me. Otherwise, it's just kind of ridiculous. I mean, I don't mean to sound cruel, but it's kind of a misnomer. And if Minahan, you know, just kind of takes that idea that we just talked about and just plays with it, and he understands it's sort of like Rome, you know, if left unchecked, we would do that kind of thing here, and, you know, doesn't really kind of put it past us to kind of put everyone in an arena and just let each other rip each other apart for the entertainment of the masses.
Yeah, I'm gonna digress really fast here and talk about Survivor. This was 2001 when this movie came out, and Survivor was just, you know, in its very early days at this point. This is back when Survivor actually meant something. You know, they wouldn't give the contestants very much food. They were pretty much out there starving a lot of times. They had the one comfort item that they could bring. Since then, it's been like, oh, my knee hurts. Oh, we gotta send you off, you know. No blood or carnage or anything, which you were expecting from this show. But yeah, it's funny to think about how that series has definitely tamed down over the years. But then there are other series that are just as bloodthirsty, but not as bloodthirsty as Series 7.
Well, actually, when Series 7 was filming, Survivor hadn't even come out yet.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, the only kind of reality TV that was on at the time was, okay, you had The Real World, mm-hmm. which MTV had been doing, I think, maybe a few years.
Right.
And then you had, like game competitions, like American Gladiators. I don't know if you remember American Gladiators.
Oh, do I ever? We used to play the home game in my dorm, yeah.
And then you had just the way people talk to the camera mm-hmm. and they interact with the crew in that way reminds me of Cops.
Right.
Which Minahan has said is Cops was a huge influence on Series 7. And you could totally see it. You have all of these things that were just sort of kind of bubbling up at the time. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was really interesting how he was able to kind of take these sort of small little elements that were out there and put it together and make a satire when the genre itself hadn't fully bloomed yet.
Right.
Like, usually you don't get a parody or a satire of something until that kind of film has, or TV show or whatever, has kind of run its course.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he was really forward-thinking with this at the time.
Yeah, it's like he knew the vocabulary even when the words weren't even being formed yet. And just, yeah, to be able to take those building blocks and just, I mean, yeah, everything that he was doing just hit perfectly with this. I mean, all the little bumpers that he did, doing the whole, like, coming up next kind of thing. I mean, they beat that dead horse like crazy on shows like Kitchen Nightmares or any of the Gordon Ramsay American shows.
And those bumpers are great, because one of the things that really helps to sell it for me is those bumpers is the way, like you were saying, the way they're built, the way they're constructed, the way they're edited. But the narrators,
oh, yeah.
The voiceover narrator, and there's a couple of different narrators, but the one main narrator who does most of those and the narration during the quote unquote film during the show is actually a pre-Arrested Development Will Arnett.
Right.
And he hits the tone just like that kind of smarmy, you know, voiceover. Will she survive? Coming up, the contenders and all this. And he's got this real attitude to it.
Will Dawn be able to eliminate Jeff, or will her feelings for him get in the way? Can Jeff really change from an ex-gay pacifist to a fierce contender? Does he have the guts to do battle with Dawn and get the job done?
And they worked it so well. Like, they construct that so well. And to have him, who, I mean, he was pretty much an unknown at the time compared to what, you know, Will Arnett is now. They just picked, I think, the right guy. Just,
oh, yeah.
Just in terms of his ability to bring that across.
I love him, but the one that I like even more is that little, just the little snippet of that woman's voice just going, Series 7, you know, and it's just, it's perfect. I love that, and that they have the little Target emblem and stuff going on. I'm surprised that they didn't actually, like, tag the bottom right-hand corner with, like, you know, the Series 7 logo or something like you would do today, or, like, the channel logo that you're watching it on.
Yeah, I'm sure that was before the little, I guess, watermarks or burn-in on the corner of the TV on every channel that you watch. Beyond the narrator, it's just the acting and the characters are really interesting because of the mix. I mean, he has this huge mix.
Five contenders have been randomly selected using government-issued identification numbers. Drawings were done under the strict observation of the accountants at Hurwitz and Silverman. Let's meet our new contenders.
He's got the teenage girl. You've got the older lady, the angel of death nurse. You've got the artist, who I find it very interesting. In the early days of the script, he was... I think he had AIDS, but in this one he had testicular cancer. So there was questions about his sexuality and things going on into that. You had the conspiracy nut, who really kind of gets shortchanged in the film, but I think after talking to Minahan, I can understand why they kind of shortchanged him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there. He works well as a foil. You've got the very abusive husband with the thick Bronx accent going on, or Brooklyn accent. I'm sorry for everyone in the Bronx and Brooklyn if I mix up your accents. And then you've got Dawn herself, who's got a lot of family problems, and she's pregnant, and so that adds a lot of tension to the film as well. But yeah, all of these different types of characters and how they interact with each other. And it takes that, like, we're all living in the same house, real world kind of thing, and just explodes it out to the nth degree. And everybody hits their performances just absolutely perfectly in this.
And the one that you left out is the high school girl.
Oh, no, I talked about her very first.
Oh, okay.
The girl. Yeah, the high school girl. I do enjoy her, and I love her relationship with her parents.
Yeah, yeah, her parents is sort of like... At first, they're a little bit taken, especially the mother, mm-hmm. who's like, no, no, you can't have my baby, no, no. And then eventually they become sort of like stage parents, right. where they're like, go ahead, honey, here's your gun, go shoot her, go get that old man and all that. But the one scene that I thought was really interesting and kind of a comment on society on another level is there's a scene where Lindsay, the high school girl, and her boyfriend are sort of making out before, like, the game starts. It's like mm-hmm. she's been selected. She knows she's going to have to go out and start doing this. And they're in her bedroom and they're making out and whatnot. And he's, like, trying to, like, get her into sex.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, no, and, like, pushes him away. That is the American dichotomy here. Violence, thumbs up. Sex, thumbs down.
Right.
And it's like, if it was a European film,
right.
it would be... We're going to have sex, then I'm going to go out and kill these people. I'm protecting my honor and my virginity, and, you know, but I have no problem with bloodshed.
Well, it's funny, the whole, there are so many different levels to this film that are just fascinating to me. You know, you've got the main narrative going on of just people hunting and killing other people, but then everybody has that secondary and tertiary kind of level going on where, like, the one character, the abusive husband, there's the abusive husband angle to it. And you've got the wife who's basically trying to use the show as the way to tell her story and basically plead for help to get out of this relationship. And you've got Dawn and her sister and her mother and all these kind of things. And then you've got just the powder keg of all of it is that Dawn is competing against one of her former flames, Jeff, and just their history together. And he's the guy with the testicular cancer, and he's got this, you know, very overbearing wife, and just all of that stuff going on. I mean, they could leave all that stuff out if you wanted to and just make it a straightforward movie about people hunting people. But that's what brings everything home, is just you've got so many facets to these characters that it makes them, for lack of a better word, feel real.
You brought up the nurse character, the senior citizen, the elderly nurse character, Connie. And once again, much like Lindsay, I think, where Minahan's making a point, especially with her religiosity, where she's very religious. We see her go to church and she prays and all this stuff, but she's like, I'm going to tear her head off. And there's this whole thing where it's like, oh, well, you think someone who would be, you know, Christ-like and all of this stuff would be much less violent. And it's like, no, he's like, you can be a believer and be just as violent and nasty as anyone else.
I love that shot of her there with her rosary smoking that cigarette. I love that shot. And that's the thing, is this whole, the movie, I mean, not only is it filmed like a reality show, but it's just beautifully shot. There are so many awesome shots in this thing and so many things that were done. You know, he did such a good job of having it scripted, but then having the right amount of ad-lib in it as well. And just capturing those moments, those things that, you know, when you're doing a reality show, when you're doing a documentary, these little gifts, like the little girl, Dawn's niece, who, when she hugs her and looks up at the camera, and you get that, like, oh, that's just so perfect, you know? And every single one of those is just like, wow, that's great.
And that was one of the things also, is that the casting is so good. Oh, in that, outside of Brooke Smith, who plays Dawn, who's probably best known, I would say, to most pop culture audience at the time when this came out, was Catherine Martin in Silence of the Lambs, as basically the girl in the pit in Silence of the Lambs. Outside of her, there's really no faces. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that really works, is that I don't think you could do this film with people who we already have an investment in terms of celebrity status.
Right, right.
Or known faces.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these actors are ones that you will see now, you know, 10 years on, and be like, oh yeah, I think I've seen him before. I've seen him, you know, a lot of these actors have run the gauntlet, as one of my actress friends says. You know, they've done, you know, CSI, New York, Law and Order, you know, like every single one of these shows, like every single type of Law and Order that there is out there, you know, it's like, have you made it through every Law and Order that you possibly can? And yeah, I think that most of the actors have gone on to do all the Law and Order, but a lot of these people were stage actors. And I think that that's what helped as well. You know, they've got the chops. They just aren't familiar faces on camera. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will play the interview that we did with director Daniel Minahan and star Brooke Smith.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
When I came out of school, I went to film school, and I think I was studying video art, which, you know, I realized right away wasn't going to be a very lucrative career, at least not in the, you know, in the 90s. So I started working on, I had a whole other career before my current career, which was as a journalist. And I did like short form documentaries for the BBC and for PBS. And then I got sort of hired away to work at Fox. Which was, it wasn't Fox, it wasn't quite the dark star that it is now. It was a different, you know, it was The Simpsons and different stuff. But I was working at Fox, and I got really, you know, I was working on a news magazine show, and I got really fascinated by another Fox show called Cops. And I thought it was really great because it kind of flew in the face of everything that I understood about, you know, documentary storytelling and journalistic integrity. And there were these really forced, crazy situations and really exploitative. And so I you know, started watching all these other shows, and that's sort of where the idea came from. And I was really fascinated with the correspondents that I worked with at Fox, and I would read all of their fan mail and their death threats and all this crazy stuff. And just the whole machine of that world was really interesting to me. And then when I finally quit there, I wrote the script for this. And I kind of based it on a lot of stuff like The Tenth Victim and The Running Man and Ben-Hur and Spartacus, you know, like all kinds of gladiator stories.
Ms. Smith, you were involved with the project from really early days of this, correct?
Yeah, I guess I was. Dan saw me in a play, and we had a mutual friend. I remember this friend of ours saying, oh, my friend Dan is going to get in touch with you, and I got a letter. And we took it to the Sundance Filmmakers Lab and workshopped it there.
Yeah, I was glad to see that footage on the DVD. That was awesome. It was neat to see where the project was versus what it became. So what were your first impressions of Dan when you met him? I know, well, it's awkward, you know, with him in the room, but...
No, yeah, I can call you later.
Okay.
At first, I was really anxious about violence, and this was like... This was during, I just remember this was when Tarantino was starting to become a big deal, and I was not really a fan of those films, and I was just really nervous about the violence, that's all. I didn't want it, you know, it's that thin line between commenting on violence and just being sort of exactly what you're not into. It took a while, and it was hard for me, honestly, to let go, as an actress, to let go of having the behind the scenes that we had when we were at Sundance. But then at that point, once we were at Sundance, I knew how great Dan was, so I totally trusted him and went with it. And now, here, all these years later, I think it's really intelligent and really cool that we didn't have the behind the scenes.
Originally, the concept for it was that it was a film, and you were seeing what was happening on the show and then also what was happening backstage sort of with the cameraman and the relationships between the camera operators and the producers and the contestants or the, you know, the contenders. Once we realized that we were going to do this as a digital film, we realized that we wouldn't be able to really differentiate as clearly. And we just thought it was a more interesting idea to play the whole thing as if it was a show.
From watching it, one would think this is taking the idea, like you said, with an inspiration from Cops at the time, because this was all created pre-Survivor. Was it a tightly written script, and did people stick to what was on the page, or was there a lot of room for improv in order to make it seem so sort of reality TV?
You know, it was tightly scripted. I think only the little interview parts were improvised, where Dan would sort of get us in a room, or, you know, I remember Lindsay, I remember you saying, you know, what do you think of Dawn? And her saying, you know, what did she think of some rambling thing that was so hilarious.
The interviews were scripted originally, and then when we started to shoot them, we realized that they sounded scripted. They weren't as natural as they could have been. So I said, let's throw away the script on the interviews, you know, and I'll just interview you as the character. And so that's what we did. There was stuff that happened, just like in any film. I think, you know, you prepare everything, you think about it for a long time, you write the script, and then, you know, you get into rehearsal or you get on the set, and, you know, everybody brings their take on it as well. And you just kind of, you know, negotiate that, and you go through it and pick the stuff that really is exciting and works the best.
I was always curious about the character, and I'm blanking on his name. I want to say Frank. Yeah, Franklin. The conspiracy guy, he seemed to really kind of end up on the cutting room floor. Was there any particular reason, or is it just for pacing?
I think of all the characters, the Franklin mob character was the most sort of cinematic, or in what I mean by cinematic is the most, like, kind of conventional, and he came across seeming contrived because he was very, having a conspiracy theorist in there seemed just somehow a little bit preposterous when we started watching it. It wasn't as truthful as I'd hoped it would have been. But then also, I think with, you know, with that many characters in a story, you know, certain ones are going to become the primary characters, and others will sort of become secondary. You know, you kind of have a A, B, and a C plot to it. So I think there's no reflection on him. You know, I think on the actor, I think he did a great job. But I think the character wasn't as successful or interesting as the other one.
When it came to casting, how did you come across the various people who were in the film? And then one in particular I wanted to ask about is Will Arnett. This is a role for him that was before Arrested Development, and people know him from Arrested Development. How did he come in, and how did you get to know him?
Before he came in, I heard, you know, we were listening to people's demo reels, and Will had done a lot of, he has like a fantastic voice. He had done a lot of voiceover work and not as much film work. So at that point, so I got, you know, I heard his voice, and I was like, whoa, that's a great voice. Let's bring him in. And I met him, and he was just so great. He was so believable as the sort of host of the show. And he was hilarious. I mean, he could do anything. And he was really patient. You know, the process working with the promo producer, Jason Bowers, was very involved. And we edited for a long time to get the promos within the film to look just right. And so we kept revoicing the promos. And Will was, you know, he would come in with us into the edit room all the time. I mean, many times, and revoice things. And he was just great.
As for the rest of the cast, were they just people that came in who had came in for a call, or were there specific people that when you were writing the script, you said this person would be great for the teenager or the older nurse Connie character or whoever?
Susan Shopmaker, who was our casting director, was like the perfect fit for this because she, aside from doing features, sort of has the market cornered in New York by casting real people in commercials. You know, she sort of collects people. And she had brought in all these amazing, you know, people. One of my favorites is Mike Kaycheck, who plays the part of Tony. Mike is actually a retired narcotics cop, and he is sort of a natural actor, and he just meshed so well and brought so much to that character. He was a boxer, so we did this boxing stuff with him, and he was great. Mary Louise Burke is a really seasoned theater actress in New York, and she came in, and it was sort of between her and two other actresses, and I got to see her in this crazy David Lindsay Abaire play called Fuddy Mirrors, and she played a person with aphasia, and she was so hilarious, and she had to, like, she killed some guy with a shovel on stage, and I thought, that's my girl. Like, she was really great. And Merritt Weaver there was just no doubt when I met Merritt that, you know, she was so remarkable. Not everybody who came in, we saw a lot of actors and actresses, but not everyone understood how to act a person who was on camera. So, you know, the people who were in the film really, you know, somehow they just got it. And Glenn Fitzgerald was one of those actors who came in, and we'd seen a lot of people for that role. We'd even developed it with another person, and then we ended up having a meeting with Glenn. He was a meeting-only type actor, and he was, again, one of those people that came in, and he completely embodied the character. I thought he was perfect. The part of that Lindsay's mother, we'd seen a bunch of people for that, too, and just by chance, we found this person that we loved. She fell out, and then, you know, we were really committed to finding, using people who people wouldn't recognize right away. And Donna Hanover really wanted to come in, and, you know, in New York City, where we cast the film and where our production was, Donna Hanover at the time, you know, was married to Rudolph Giuliani, and we were really worried that she would be too recognizable, and they were going through this divorce, and she was just amazing. She has the quality I was looking for of somebody who is a real person kind of caught on camera.
The Dawn character, I wanted to ask Brooke as well. I mean, how did that kind of evolve for you? I mean, and how did that character sort of develop for you over sort of from the script to the final stage? I mean, were there certain things you added to it, certain things you brought?
The fact that Dan saw me in this play, it was so specific. I was playing this crazy dominatrix from Queens who was a speed freak. So for some reason, that I never lost that. That always informed somehow who Dawn was. And also, for some reason, I immediately flashed on somebody I knew when I was a young punk rocker. It just felt like I could just let it rip, you know? Like, I once I figured out who she was, and even at Sundance, right? Didn't we sort of just... It just sort of... I don't know. It was all kind of on the page. I don't know. I just... I love Dawn, I have to say. I think she's great. The hair. I remember the hair.
The hair was a big part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and how my hairstylist was like, you're going to ruin your hair. This is never going to come back, you know. But it was so important to me that she had, you know, gotten pregnant and decided she wasn't going to dye her hair because that wasn't good for a baby. And, you know, so to let the roots grow out, that was a whole thing. And then...
You didn't let the roots grow. You actually dyed your hair blonde and then dyed the roots black.
So it looked I had roots. Yeah, exactly. And then, and the costume also. I thought, you know, Christine Beeslin, who was our costume designer, did a really great job. Like, so often when I go in for fittings, it's like, oh, this person has no idea what I have in mind. And just from day one, she really seemed to have it.
The great thing about Brooke for me, you know, aside obviously from seeing her in that play that we're talking about, which I think is called Little Monsters, you know, I had seen her in Bonnie and 42nd Street, and which is probably closer to who Brooke is, a person, the character of Sonia is a very sensitive person. But then, of course, then you see her as Catherine in Silence of the Lambs, and you see her strength. And I knew between seeing Sonia and Catherine that she had both the qualities of this character and also could be incredibly funny. You know, but not at the cost of the character. You know, I mean, I felt completely safe that Dawn was in good hands. Dawn Legardo, by the way, also is the name of my childhood best friend. You know, we were going to change the name of the character for legal reasons, and then Brooke wouldn't let us change the name of the character. She was Dawn Legardo at that point and completely committed to it. So I had to go to Dawn Legardo, which is one of the strangest conversations I've ever had with someone to say, hey, I'd like really like to use your name for this character in the film. She was like, there's a long silence. She was like, oh, cool. You know, and I think she still somehow gets residual checks.
Yeah, she's the only one, by the way.
How was the production, sort of the day-to-day, and maybe what were some challenges or interesting stories in trying to put the film together?
Well, the first thing I think of is the motel where we were living, right? What was it, the Super 8? Which is actually in the film. I just remember at the end of long, long shooting days that I had to sneak my Basset Hound in by using the production van and carrying him up on top of the van and shoving him through the second floor window because they didn't allow dogs. although the halls seem to be filled with naked prostitutes and crackheads. That's the first thing I think of. Dan?
You know, it was like a regular indie production. We used all real locations. We shot it in the town that I grew up in. It's not in the 30-mile zone from Manhattan, but we realized that we would get a lot of production value and a lot of, you know, could call in a lot of favors there. So, well, I didn't use any locations that were actually, you know, my family's home. I used friends of the family who were very accommodating and let us shoot there.
What about Connie's house?
The house that was Connie's was a woman that's a very close friend of my mother's, and she had a brand new kitchen table, which we promised her we'd take good care of, and then we ended up shooting the scene where Dawn gives birth on the kitchen table. And the one that props brought wasn't quite big enough, so we ended up using her kitchen table. And I think she recognized it when she saw the film. But
we didn't hurt it.
It went off without a hitch, though, I have to say. The actors did all their own stunt driving. I mean, it's a little bit crazy, some of the stuff we did. We shot on highways that were under construction, that were closed down. Locations and production people, our producer Katie Rommel, did an incredible job. The helicopter shot is one of my favorite things, and the way we did that I thought was kind of really clever. This researcher found us. I described the chase that we wanted, because I was obsessed at the time with high-speed pursuit, and we found footage of a truck that we liked. Unfortunately, it was in Los Angeles, but we found shots of it that were all tight enough that just showed it on the highway, and then we matched the truck to the real truck in the footage and found a stretch of highway that looked close enough. I felt really lucky. You know, it wasn't one of those things like, oh, God, that was the hardest thing I ever did. It was really, really well produced.
And the mall. Remember the mall?
Yeah, we had an entire mall in Waterbury, Connecticut. The one thing that we found, though, is that places like, they would allow us to shoot there, but they wouldn't allow us to identify it. So, like, the Catholic church that Connie goes to is a church in my neighborhood, but we weren't allowed to show the name of the church, or the mall is this mall in Waterbury, Connecticut. I don't know how many there are, but, you know, we couldn't use the name of the mall, which was fine. I mean, but we had incredible luck with that kind of thing.
I almost think that's a blessing, because it makes it feel more universal, like it could be taking place in Connecticut or right next door.
That was one thing that the production designer, who's such a remarkable guy, Gideon Ponte, you know, we agreed on right away that all of the locations should be unremarkable. And by that, I mean, they were sort of, I didn't want them to be archetypal locations. Like, you know, you see a movie and there'll be this incredible, you know, silver diner car. I thought this was a chance for the design of the film to show a different kind of Americana and what it's really like.
Now, after you were able to complete the film, I guess maybe there was at least two endings. I know there's the ending that's on the film, and then I haven't seen the DVD extras yet, but I understand there was a second ending. Can you explain what your ending choices were and why you selected the one you did?
The ending was going to be like a ritual stoning, where the characters escaped the show, and then they were cornered by the audience. They sort of kidnapped this whole audience and held them hostage as a way of getting out of their obligation to the show. And the audience then, as they left, the audience followed them out, and you thought they were following them out in support, and then they beat them to death in the parking lot. And we shot that ending, you know, and we tried to make it look as much like we actually, as a reference, we used the Rodney King footage. And then when we saw it, it just didn't ring true. It wasn't as interesting as we thought it would be. It was more of a literary conceit, and it wasn't gratifying. So when we put the first cut together and we watched it with the producers, you know, I said, I got to come up with something else. So we came up with this other idea.
I like how you didn't necessarily define everything with the game right up front or even throughout the film, that it was just so faceless. And I like too that you made the decision to not have the cameramen participating as openly as you had in the Sundance thing, because that also kind of kept them more faceless as well, and just that it was such a much more darker theme to it, that they were completely helpless as they were doing this.
USA put a lot of pressure on me to try to define the rules of the game right up front, which we did in a very minor way with the whole setup of the town and the location. But, you know, the idea that this exists in a world, it's satire. So I felt like the more you explained it, the weaker it would become.
Speaking of the reaction, once it was out and you did the screenings at Sundance and things like that, what did you hear and what were you sort of surprised by when people actually saw the film?
Well, I kept getting this question of, like, you know, from people like, well, would you like to direct a film now? And I think it confused people, the idea that you would come into the movie theater, sit down, and you watch a TV series. It was a hard road to walk. I mean, I think, like, whenever you deal with something that's so sensational and violent, I think it's a big responsibility. And we also treated it as a black comedy. So I feel like the right people liked it. I expected it to be divisive. I didn't expect it to be that divisive. I mean, some people were really tough on it and hard on me. As a first-time director, it kind of stung. It was kind of, you know, people were questioning whether I was even a good director. And I mean, I thought that was absurd. You know, I mean, I thought that people would judge the film on its own merit rather than... But I think when there's something that has such an intense voice, and it's so... I mean, we considered it really carefully, but, you know, I think people would think that it was really sensationalistic, and I think it gave people license to say things that they might not have said. I remember being in London and journalists asking me if I had a gun. And I thought, wow, it's so, like, I guess you didn't really see the film. You know, then I also had someone ask me if I thought that most people in America had guns. You know, it was interesting, the reaction of it. It was very strong. I don't know if I was quite prepared for it.
I was always curious how much support you got from USA Films, just in terms of distribution, both theatrically and via VHS and DVD.
Well, the film opened in a very limited way. It opened, I think, New York and Los Angeles in like one or two theaters in each place. And then it started to go wider. I think they were very conservative because of the subject matter. I think there had been a high school shooting, literally. It was an unfortunate thing. It happened just like the week before or something crazy like that. And I think it made them a little bit timid, a little bit wary about it. But it seems to me like a lot of people see it. The crazy thing for me is I'll go into a meeting here with a studio executive who's usually like 10 years younger than me, and they'll say, oh, man, we studied your film in college.
Oh.
You know?
I'm curious how you would have marketed this thing at all. I mean, it just, the subject matter is so, it could be so controversial. I'm curious where you think that they should have done a better job with it.
You know, I'm not in marketing, and I think that's a really special skill set. I think that they were trying to be very creative. I think maybe in some instances it confused the people who would have seen the film as to what it was. But I don't think I have a better idea of how they might have marketed it, except to spend, you know, more money. They did clever promos for it where, you know, when we started the film, it was before the advent of Survivor and reality shows. I mean, there were shows like Cops, but not bad shows that involved battle or competition, you know, that were sort of game shows. And so they kind of latched on to the Survivor thing, which I thought was clever. Also, I think, you know, by the time it came out, people were also kind of like sick and offended by Survivor. So I don't know how well that worked, but I thought the trailers were clever. I think the tone of it was always the tricky part, making it clear that it's a black comedy. I think social satire is not something that you can easily market and make look appealing. I was pretty happy with the trailers. The posters, meh, you know, whatever.
I think they should re-release it now.
10 years on since it's been out, obviously reality TV has not died. what do you think about it now, looking back on it? Do you think it still makes the statement? And if you had the chance to do it again today, would you change anything? Would it be stronger in its satire, or pick different targets?
I don't think I would change it. I think it's kind of it's the film I wanted to make, so I feel really lucky that way. It's not like I don't have any regret about the way it turned out. I thought it worked out really beautifully, and it's very true to itself. I don't watch reality TV now. I find it really depressing and sad. I at the time I was really, when we made the film, I was really fascinated by it in a kind of crazy, ironic way. And we all got into it. Brooke and Glenn, who played Jeff, the three of us, we would all watch hours and hours of it and compare notes and collect videotapes. But I don't really get the same pleasure for it now. It just seems really craven and depraved. And it, I think, which means that it would probably be just as relevant now.
What do you think you've learned from the film that maybe you use today, or certain technique in making film or acting or something like that?
Dan?
Well, the ultimate irony of it is that, you know, I ended up doing a lot of television work. Like, for the last 10 years, I've been working pretty much exclusively in television. Not this type, not that type of television, but like dramatic series. I think it gave me a confidence and that I had a voice. And, you know, it was a way for me to do something, you know, coming from documentaries, it gave me a way to do something that I knew how to do, and a chance to work with great actors. If I could survive that, I could do pretty much anything.
Revisiting the film, even just in my mind today, I'm thinking, well, damn it, you know, we could just, I should just make my own films, for God's sakes, because these films are not being made. I don't think they were being made then, and I really like the film. I don't like a lot of films, and I really think it's a great movie.
I think people show it to students in film schools now because it's an example of how you can make a great story with not a lot of means. I think it's encouraging to people, not in an instructive way, but just, you know, as an example of, you know, here are these people. It's like an early digital film that people made for not a lot of money and tell a great story.
You guys have worked together a few times since then, right? I mean, like on 6 Feet Under and Grey's Anatomy?
Yeah, people keep putting us together.
Yeah, he's trying to get rid of me, but, you know.
Brooke accuses me of bringing her in, and I'm like, they're always like, how about Brooke Smith? And I'm like, well, okay.
No.
I think people use me to get to her, so.
I'm very jealous when he works with other actors. So it's a good thing I don't have a gun.
Brooke, I've got to ask you, one of your most famous roles, of course, is Catherine Martin in Silence of the Lambs. What kind of weirdos do you get, if any, because you were in that role?
You know, I don't get any weirdos so much anymore. There was one time something really disturbing happened. No one's ever asked me this. I was in a play, I went on stage, I came back, and my entire dressing room, did you know this, Dan, was filled with roses and a card, and it was from this guy, and I'm not kidding you, he literally took a picture of himself as if he was at the top of the well. I guess he thought it was witty, and said, you know, something like, we have so much in common, we both like Tom Waits and blah, 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 and I was like, oh, dear God. And one time, weirdly, really weirdly, I was asked to be a witness at, like, an actual murder trial. And I thought, well, this is really icky and weird. And no, I didn't witness anything. I have no idea why you want me to come in. If I had a dollar for every time someone said,
now it places the lotion in the basket,
that would be good. But, yeah, no weirdos, really.
Are you familiar with the musical version of Silence of the Lambs?
I am. I was, you know, I just was in New York, and I was only there for a few days, and the still photographer from the film, from Silence of the Lambs, I saw him, and he said that Jonathan and Jody and everybody, they were all going to see it, but I unfortunately wasn't there. I heard it's great.
Oh, I didn't know that they were actually staging it. I've only heard the music from, like, years ago.
There are posters all over my neighborhood in New York for it.
Oh, wow.
I intentionally never mentioned it to you.
Oh, you should go see it. The coolest thing ever was that I was a Mad Magazine drawing. There was a picture of me in the well, you know, when they did their spoof on it. That was very cool.
There's also a theater troupe in Boston that I know that they did a Christmas version of Silence of the Lambs called Silent Night of the Lambs. And this woman that we know actually played Catherine Martin.
You can't get away from it.
It's a pretty good movie, though, so I'm okay with it.
So, Brooke, are you going to be on Game of Thrones anytime soon? Is that what Dan's trying to tell us?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if Dan will have me in. But no, I have no plan. God damn it. I have no plans to be in anything. I've been writing and hoping to make my own film, but yeah.
Brooke's just had an amazing show of photography in New York that was up for like a month. Of all these photographs that she took during her hardcore days at CBGB's. And it's a beautiful show.
Thank you, Dan.
Anything else maybe that you want to add about Series 7 that we forgot to ask you about, or something that kind of sticks out in your head that maybe we've jarred loose in your memory since we've been talking?
I keep hearing when I go to meetings, certain meetings, I've heard this 3 times now in L.A., that Will Ferrell, and actually he said it in a magazine, didn't he, that it was one of his favorite films. And I went on a meeting once, and the director said that Will was a good friend of his, and he knew that Will had stolen his only copy of the film. And then there was a video store actually just closed here, Rocket Video in L.A., and they told me the same thing, that they were pretty convinced it was Will Ferrell who stole their copy. So,
yeah, Will Ferrell,
we're on to you, Will.
Yeah, he put it on his top 10 films to see before you die list, so I felt pretty happy about that. He's awesome.
It's great to hear that Minahan and Smith are still friends and hanging out. We talked a few weeks ago about Peter Watkins' Punishment Park, which was a very important entry in the whole faux documentary field. I'd argue that Series 7 was just as important in terms of the way that it played with the early building blocks of reality TV. I mean, these days, you know, mockumentaries are like a dime a dozen, especially those claiming to be found footage, like literally footage that we found in the camera, not like that kind of Bruce Conner kind of found footage. Likewise, there's been been an entire television series based on the conceit of being an overtly fake Joe Schmo type of show, as opposed to the way that other reality shows have faked and restaged scenes and scripted dialogue. I'm looking at Eugene Simmons when I'm saying that. Series 7 comes across as this very prescient look at where television and entertainment was heading and where we have yet to go. I do find it very funny, too, when I think about this, that I talked when we talked about Punishment Park, that I said that the first time that I had seen it was a friend of mine from Toronto had given me a tape of it. When I think about Series 7 now, it's another friend of mine from Toronto, Dion Conflict, who gave me a VHS tape of this film. So there must be something about faux documentaries in Toronto and VHS tapes. So I'm waiting for the next time I go up there, maybe somebody will give me the next movie that I fall in love with. I didn't get Battle Royale that way, which I think kind of completes this trifecta, but, you know, one of these days, next time I go up there, I'm waiting for some good VHS tapes to come out of it.
It's interesting that you talk about, hey, we found the footage, kind of Cannibal Holocaust, Blair Witch, that right. kind of thing. Because that was only, Blair Witch was only 2 years before, and it was 99.
Right.
So it was already sort of in our heads that, at least in this period, in this block of time, that faux documentary was starting to be used for other purposes, at least that people in the popular culture, it crossed over
right.
with Blair Witch, where people could go along with it. I remember working in the theater when that came out, and people were like adamant that it was real. I said, to which I told them, I said, yeah, you know, their parents must be very cynical to make a ton of money off the deaths of their kids.
Exactly.
You know, would your parents sign away the rights to use the found footage of your death?
Right.
Or disappearance?
Well, now it's, I mean, really, they are such a dime a dozen. When I even look back at 2011, just like, you know, okay, well, there's Apollo 18 and Paranormal Activity, which is up to Paranormal Activity 3, and it's just like, my God, you know, it's like, and then, you know, even like, well, Super 8 played a little bit with that, but I like the Cloverfield as being kind of that found footage kind of stuff too, and it's just like, and those are the ones that are coming out, you know, to major theaters. These aren't even the ones that are, you know, direct to video or direct to Netflix or whatever the means of distribution are for these films.
But the thing is a lot of these faux documentaries, I don't think have message in them. They don't have a lot of a social message. And while Series 7 is definitely not Punishment Park, sort of message heavy in that way, it's very fun. It's run and gun. You can enjoy it on one level. I don't think it's overly gory, you know.
No, but it's one of the movies that I can't pop in and watch while my wife's around. It's real enough that it's very much like Cops. You know, it's real enough that when we watch it, when I try to watch it and she's around, it's like, God, I get real violence all the time, you know, in her line of work. Why do we have to watch this stuff when we're at home? You know, we can watch the cleaned up version. We can watch the Condemned or the Assassin movie with Robert Carlyle, these kind of things. But, you know, watching it when it has that sheen of realness to it, just no, too much.
And using that sheen of realness with something like this, and using what, as we were talking about, sort of the language that was still being built in terms of reality TV, and using Cops as a model, I think that what Minahan's really saying is he's trying to shake us and say, look, this is where it can go. As I was talking about in the introduction, it's like, if you're going to call it Survivor, well, eventually it's going to be Survivor. There will only be one Survivor. So, you know, let's just take this as far out as we can take it. And, you know, let me shake you by the lapels and show you how crazy you are because you enjoy this kind of bloodlust and this sort of pushing further and pushing further and further and further to have quote unquote real entertainment, whatever that is. But it's actually, as we were saying, going back to the old idea of things like, as he was talking about in the interview, gladiators.
Right.
Going back to Rome. Is the TV the new Colosseum, or as, you know, Cronenberg told us, you know, the Videodrome?
Right.
You know,
long live the new flesh.
When I look at Series 7, the only thing that you could add to it, in my mind, that would hype the level of satire up a little bit, make a little bit more statement on commercialism, would be fake commercials.
That would have been good.
Yeah. Like RoboCop, where you had these, you know, parodies of things that were just taken to the nth degree, like the Nukem game and the thing with the car that, you know, gets really shitty gas mileage. But, you know,
yeah,
it's like if you did things like that, that would be like the only way you could like bump it up one more level. I'm sure it may have like broken the flow of, you know, the rhythm of the piece, and it definitely would have shot the budget up. But outside of that, like I said, in terms of a satire, I think it's dead on. I think Series 7.
Well, I find it very, very sad almost that Minahan was saying that after the screening at Sundance and all these other screenings, people would come up and be like, when are you going to make a real movie? You know, like this one didn't count because it was such a parody of television. It was like it was too dead on for people to realize that it was a movie, you know. And I'm sure that there are people that probably at least one out of, I don't know, 1,000 that think that this movie is real, that this was a real TV show at some point, you know, and they're probably looking for Series 8 and Series 6 and Series 5, etc. You know, because they've got the preview for Series 8 on there, and it's just like, my God, you know. But yeah, it's like, I think that would have probably hurt him a little bit in that it would have been too TV-y, but God, yeah, I think that would have been great. I think it would have been really cool to see more of what this world is, and I'm glad that he doesn't go into the rules so much of the game, because I think that would have thrown it into the sci-fi realm, because when I'm talking about The Running Man and these other films, they feel a lot more sci-fi-ish than Series 7. And I think movies like this or like Punishment Park, they do well to hold back that information and not make that all part of the thing.
As you brought up Battle Royale, in the front end of Battle Royale, they're like, okay, unemployment's high, the kids are running amok, so the government has created this program.
Right.
In Series 7, you don't know why there's a lotto. There's just a lotto. And they just pick people, and they put guns in their hand, and they go off and kill each other.
Right.
There's no explanation as to why they do this. Mm-hmm. It's just done.
Right.
And you can, I guess, come up with your own theory on why that is. Either, you know, the producers were able to get some sort of dispensation from the government to do this because they thought the ratings would be good and it would pacify the people watching TV.
Right.
Or who knows? It sort of lives in this alternate universe of now. And
that's the thing, it's this movie is 10 years old and it doesn't feel dated. It's like, wow, this feels like it was just cut, just feels like it was just out, and, you know, it's terrific in that way, too.
And I think even more with sort of the boom in reality TV, you know, now that there's so much of it. And I have friends who are actors out in Los Angeles, and it's like, it's hard for them to get work because they don't do as many dramas and sitcoms as they used to because there's so much reality TV.
Right.
So, you know,
I can't remember which website it was, but there was a site that would take those casting call notices for different reality TV shows, and they would put them up. It might have been Smoking Gun, but it would be like, here's a new show about blah. And it would be like, you know, we need dwarves who are into tattoos and haircutting, you know, and it's like, what? And that's the thing, too, is you take those, whatever reality show is on HGTV, you know, in 2 weeks' time, it's going to be on Bravo, and it's going to be on Lifetime or Lifestyle and all these kind of different things. It's just going to be their own little twist of it. It's like, how many pawn shop shows are we going to have? How many, you know, it's crazy to see that. You know, there are so few ideas, and they just retread them and retread them and retread them. We're going to take a little break with a preview from next week's show.
A cube.
26 rooms high. 26 rooms across.
17,576 rooms.
Does anybody remember how they got here?
Why would they throw innocent people in here? Are we being punished?
There's a way in here, so there's gotta be a way out.
Do you think they'd go to all the trouble to build this thing if we could just walk out?
Take a good long look around. But I got a feeling it's looking at us.
We have about 3 days without food and water before we're too weak to move.
I just wanna wake up.
Room down there, and something almost cut my head off.
Motion detectors integrated into the walls. Tough to spot.
You're not getting out of here.
Yes, we are.
There is no way out of here.
We need to get around the trap.
They're identified by prime numbers.
Figure it out.
I can't.
I'm not dying in a rat maze.
No more talking. No more guessing. You gotta save yourselves from yourselves.
We haven't been moving in circles, the rooms have.
We have the key.
The key.
It's us.
That was a preview for The Cube. Next week, I'll be joined by Bookgasm's Rod Lott and director Vincenzo Natali to talk about this amazing film. I want to thank this week's co-host, Rob St. Mary, for visiting us again. Be sure to listen to Rob on WDET. You can listen live or get your St. Mary fix via the archives at WDET.org. Thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to check out more from The Projection Booth via iTunes, via Stitcher, on Jackalope Radio, or via our website at www.projection-booth.com. Thanks again.